A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a good one. He's been thinking about what we discussed on happiness, and he's zeroing in on something specific, this idea of conditional happiness. You know, the voice in your head that says you don't get to enjoy the ice cream until you've earned it. He mentions Bittul Torah, this Jewish concept he grew up hearing about from rabbis, where every moment not spent learning Torah is essentially wasted time. And he's asking us to dig into two things. First, the ideological roots of this belief that every waking moment must be productive, that rest is something you have to earn. And second, the counterpoints, what other traditions, religious or philosophical, have to say about this. Where's the pushback? So where do we even start with this?
I want to start with the Puritans, because Daniel flagged my observation from before, and he's right. There's a direct line, but it's more specific than most people realize. The phrase Protestant work ethic gets thrown around, but Max Weber actually wrote The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism in 1905, and he traced it to Calvinism specifically. The key doctrine was predestination. You couldn't know if you were saved, so you looked for signs. Material success, disciplined labor, these became outward evidence of being among the elect.
Wealth wasn't about enjoying wealth. It was about proving you weren't damned.
And that's the crucial distinction. Weber quotes Richard Baxter, a 17th century Puritan preacher who wrote, and this is almost verbatim, "Work hard in your calling. Do not sloth." I knew you'd take that personally. But Baxter's actual line is even more intense. He said, "Time is too precious to waste on idle talk or unprofitable company. Every hour had to be accounted for. Leisure wasn't rest. It was a lapse in vigilance." And Weber argues this ethos didn't stay in church. It became the spirit of capitalism itself. The idea that work isn't just what you do, it's who you are.
The modern productivity cult, the 4A wake-up crowd, the hustle bros, the people who treat their to-do lists like a moral ledger, the basically secular Calvinists who swap salvation for a Substack following.
That's the compressed version, yes. And it's not just the hustle culture, it's the guilt, the feeling that if you're not optimizing, you're failing. Weber saw this coming. He called it the iron cage. This rationalized, efficiency-obsessed system that we built and then got trapped inside. He wrote that it would continue until the last ton of fossilized coal is burnt. Which, I mean, he wasn't wrong about the trajectory.
This is where it connects to what Daniel was saying about Bittul Torah. Because on the surface, they sound like opposites. The Puritans are about worldly labor. Bittul Torah is about study. But the psychological mechanism is almost identical.
Let me unpack Bittul Torah for listeners who might not know the term. Literally, it means nullification of Torah, or wasting time that could be spent studying Torah. In traditional Jewish thought, Torah study is the highest mitzvah, the highest commandment. The Mishnah in Pia says, Talmud Torah neged kulam. Torah study is equal to all the other commandments combined. So if every moment could theoretically be spent learning Torah, any moment not doing so is a loss.
This isn't just some abstract rabbinic ideal nobody takes seriously. Daniel mentioned listening to lectures where this comes up constantly. I've heard the same thing. There's a pervasive feeling in certain Orthodox circles that if you're sitting on a bus and you're not reviewing a passage of Mishnah, you're spiritually hemorrhaging.
The Shofetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, who lived in the late 19th and early 20th century, wrote extensively about this. He calculated how many words of Torah a person could learn in a minute, in an hour, in a day, and then framed every idle moment as an irreplaceable loss. It's essentially spiritual time and motion studies.
The Frederick Winslow Taylor of Torah.
Taylorism applied to the soul. And the emotional residue, as Daniel put it, is subtle shame. You're not burning in hell for eating ice cream. But there's this quiet voice saying, you could be doing something holier right now, and that voice doesn't clock out. It's there at the beach, at the dinner table, watching a documentary. Whatever you're doing that isn't study becomes Bittul Torah.
What's fascinating to me is how both systems, Puritan work ethic, and Beitel Torah converge on the same practical outcome, despite totally different theological engines. One says work proves salvation. The other says study fulfills the ultimate commandment. But both produce a person who cannot rest without guilt. Both make leisure something you have to justify.
Both are what we'd call maximalist positions. They take a genuine value, diligence, spiritual devotion, and push it to an extreme where it becomes totalizing. No off switch, no Sabbath from the Sabbath.
Actually, that's an interesting point. Judaism does have Shabbat. That's a built-in counterpoint. We'll get to that in the second part. But first, I want to stay on the ideological roots because there's a third tradition Daniel didn't mention that feeds the same beast. Marcus Aurelius in the Meditations is constantly admonishing himself to stop lying in bed, to get up and do the work of a human being. He writes, and this is from Book 5, "At dawn, when you have trouble getting out of bed, tell yourself, I have to go to work as a human being. What do I have to complain about if I'm going to do what I was born for? There's no grace for the sluggish morning, no allowance for just being tired."
Seneca's On the Shortness of Life is basically a 2,000-year-old precursor to every productivity blog ever written. He says most people squander their lives on trivial pursuits, and he's not wrong about some of it. But the underlying assumption is that life is a resource to be optimally deployed, not experienced. There's a line where he says, "It is not that we have a short time to live, but that we waste a lot of it," which sounds wise until you realize it can curdle into a perpetual anxiety about whether you're using your minutes correctly.
The Stoics gave us the original time management guild. But here's the thing. I think Stoicism, at least as popularly understood, gets misread as being purely about grit and discipline. The actual Stoic position on leisure is more nuanced. Seneca wrote a whole essay called On Leisure, where he argues that the contemplative life is valid. The problem is that the bro-Stoic revival of the last decade cherry-picks the get-out-of-bed parts and ignores the rest.
That's a fair point. And it brings us to something important about how these ideologies travel. They get flattened. Weber's Protestant ethic becomes work hard. Beitel Torah becomes never waste time. Stoicism becomes embrace the grind. The original context had nuance, had counterbalances, had escape hatches, and those get stripped away when the idea becomes a cultural mood rather than a lived tradition.
We've got three streams feeding the same river: Calvinist predestination anxiety, Jewish Torah maximalism, and Stoic self-discipline. All three say you are what you do with your time, and doing nothing of value is a moral failure. Different gods, same guilt.
I think it's worth naming something explicitly. These aren't just historical curiosities. They've merged into a kind of ambient background radiation of modern life. The tech industry's obsession with productivity metrics, the way we talk about wasting time on social media, the entire self-optimization genre, you can't trace it to one source. It's a composite.
The productivity guilt smoothie. One part Geneva, one part Yeshiva, one part Roman Forum. Blend until you can't taste the individual ingredients anymore.
Served cold every morning before your first coffee.
Let's get to the second part of the prompt. Because Daniel's not just asking us to diagnose the problem. He wants to know where the pushback lives. What traditions, religious or otherwise, say something different?
I want to start with Judaism itself, because it would be a mistake to present Beitel Torah as the whole story. The same tradition that produced the Chofetz Chaim's minute-by-minute accounting also produced something radically different. Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, which we read during Sukkot. There is nothing better for a person than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in their toil. That's chapter 2, verse 24, and it comes back again and again. Chapter 3, I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God.
Kohelet is basically the biblical counterweight to everything we just described. The whole book is a sustained argument against taking life too seriously. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. You can't optimize your way out of mortality.
It's canon. It's read in synagogue. It's not some suppressed minority report. The tradition preserved this voice that says, essentially, you're going to die. Eat the ice cream.
There's a rabbinic concept that I think directly addresses what Daniel was feeling. It's called menuchat, which is rest or tranquility of the mind. The Talmud talks about Shabbat as being about menuchat, not just ceasing physical labor, but achieving a state of mental rest. And that's not something you earn. It's commanded. You're required to stop, required to experience peace. If you don't, you're violating the commandment as surely as if you were working.
That's the critical distinction. Shabbat isn't a reward for a productive week. It's an obligation that interrupts the productive week whether you feel you've earned it or not. Every seventh day, the maximalist impulse gets overruled by divine fiat. You can't study Torah if that studying feels like labor. You can't do anything that disturbs your menuchat. The rabbis even discuss whether you're allowed to think about work problems on Shabbat, and the consensus is no. Mental rest means mental rest.
This is where the conditional happiness model breaks down, at least in theory. You don't get to say, "I'll rest when I've finished this project." The project is irrelevant. The sun sets on Friday, and you stop. The condition is external. It's imposed by the calendar, not earned by your output.
There's a beautiful midrash about this. When God gave the Torah at Sinai, one interpretation says that Shabbat was given first before the other commandments. The logic is that rest isn't what comes after the work. Rest is the foundation the work sits on. You build your week around the day of ceasing, not the other way around.
Which is the exact inversion of the Puritan model, where rest is what you get when the ledger balances.
Let me pull in another Jewish voice that directly counters the Bittul Torah maximalism. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. In his book, The Sabbath, he writes that Judaism is a religion of time, not space. The holiness isn't in a place, it's in a day. And he describes Shabbat as a palace in time. The whole book is an argument against the idea that productivity is the measure of a life. He says, and I'm paraphrasing, that we've become obsessed with things in space, with building and acquiring, and we've forgotten how to dwell in time.
Heschel also marched with Martin Luther King. He wasn't an ivory tower mystic. He was saying this in the context of the civil rights movement, in a world that desperately needed action. And his point was precisely that action, without rest, without contemplation, without joy, becomes hollow.
Let's move to Christianity, because there's a counter tradition there too. The Puritans didn't represent all of Protestantism, let alone all of Christianity. The Catholic tradition has a concept of otium sanctum, holy leisure. It's the idea that contemplative rest is not just permitted, but is itself a form of participation in the divine. Gregory the Great in the 6th century wrote about the need for a balance between the active life and the contemplative life. And he was drawing on Augustine, who was drawing on earlier sources.
Before that, the Desert Fathers. These were 4th century monks who went out into the Egyptian desert specifically to escape the distractions of productive urban life. Their whole project was about sitting in a cell, in silence, doing nothing that the world would recognize as useful. One of them, Abba Anthony, reportedly said that a time was coming when people would go mad, and when they saw someone who wasn't mad, they would attack him for being different. The non-mad person in this story is the one who's not caught up in the frenzy.
The Desert Fathers are a fascinating case because they were extreme. They weren't advocating for moderate leisure, they were advocating for total withdrawal. But they represent a recognition that the soul needs something other than productivity. And that recognition runs through Christian mysticism. Meister Eckhart in the 14th century talked about Gelassenheit, letting go-ness, a state of detachment where you're not grasping at outcomes, you're not earning anything, you're just being.
There's a Protestant counter-voice too. And it's a surprising one. Everyone thinks of Luther as the guy who kicked off the work ethic, but Luther actually wrote against what he saw as the theology of glory. The idea that human effort could achieve anything spiritually significant. He insisted on grace as a free gift. You can't earn it. The whole point of the Reformation, in Luther's version, was that the ledger model of salvation was the problem, not the solution.
That's a crucial corrective. Weber actually acknowledged this tension. Calvinism, not Lutheranism, was his focus. Luther was much more comfortable with the idea that salvation is entirely God's work and human effort is irrelevant to it. That doesn't directly translate to take a nap, but it does undermine the theological engine that drives the guilt. If you can't earn your standing, the pressure to optimize every minute loses its cosmic stakes.
Let's go east for a minute. Buddhism has an entire framework built around the problem of craving and attachment, and a lot of what we're describing, The conditional happiness model is basically craving projected onto the future. I will be happy when. That's Tanha. The second noble truth says that suffering arises from craving, and the craving doesn't have to be for sensual pleasure. It can be for achievement, for status, for becoming a better person. Spiritual materialism, some teachers call it.
Chogyam Trungpa coined that term, spiritual materialism. The idea that you can turn enlightenment itself into another thing to achieve, another box to tick, another reason to feel inadequate in the present moment. And he was specifically warning Western practitioners who were importing their productivity mindset into meditation. I've been meditating for 6 months. Why am I not enlightened yet?
The Zen tradition has this concept of just sitting. Shikantaza. It's meditation with no goal. You're not trying to attain anything. You're not counting breaths to reach a certain number. You're not working toward Kensho or Satori. You're just sitting. Dogen, the 13th century Japanese Zen master, wrote that practice and enlightenment are one. You don't practice to get enlightened. The sitting itself is the enlightenment.
That's radically counter to the conditional happiness model. The model says the present moment is a means to a future payoff. Zen says the present moment is the whole thing. There's no payoff coming. This is it.
Which sounds terrifying to someone who's built their emotional architecture around deferred gratification.
And there's an interesting parallel here with a philosophical tradition that's neither Eastern nor religious, specifically Albert Camus and the myth of Sisyphus. Sisyphus is condemned to push a boulder up a hill forever. It rolls back down. He does it again. Camus says we have to imagine Sisyphus happy, because the meaning isn't in reaching the top. There is no top. The meaning is in the pushing, in the moment of consciousness, in the absurd act of continuing without hope of final reward.
Camus is basically saying that conditional happiness is a trap, because the condition never arrives. Or if it does, it's temporary, and you set a new condition immediately. The only way out is to stop playing the condition game entirely.
He wrote this in the context of the French Resistance during World War II. This wasn't a comfortable philosopher in a comfortable study. He was staring at real despair and real absurdity and saying, no, joy is still possible, but not as a future reward. It has to be in the struggle itself.
We've got Jewish Shabbat theology, Catholic holy leisure, the Desert Fathers, Luther's grace, Buddha's non-attachment, Zen's just sitting, Camus' absurd happiness. That's a pretty robust counter-tradition. And yet, the guilt persists.
I think it's because the counter-traditions require practice. They're not just ideas you assent to. You can intellectually agree that rest is holy and still feel guilty taking a nap. The guilt is somatic. It's habitual. It's been wired in by years of conditioning. Reading Heschel doesn't deprogram the inner Puritan in one afternoon.
The broader culture is still pumping out the old message. Every productivity app, every hustle influencer, every what's your side hustle conversation at a party. It's all reinforcing the idea that your time is a resource to be mined. The counter-traditions are whispering. The culture is shouting.
There's also something Daniel touched on that I think is worth naming directly. He said he inherited this feeling from his religion, and I think there's a specific dynamic in Orthodox Jewish communities that amplifies it. In the yeshiva world, Bitul Torah isn't just a concept, it's a social metric. Your dedication is visible. Are you in the Beit Midrash during free time? Are you learning on the bus? There's a communal gaze that internalizes as self-policing.
The panopticon, but make it kosher?
That's glib, but not wrong. And it's not unique to Judaism. Every intense subculture has its version of this. Academics have publish or perish guilt. Artists have studio time guilt. Parents have quality time with kids guilt. The specific content changes, but the structure is the same. You're always falling short of the ideal, and the ideal is always maximized.
What do we do with this? Daniel's asking for counterpoints, and we've offered them. But I feel like we need to land somewhere practical. What does a functioning alternative actually look like?
I think the Jewish model of Shabbat is instructive precisely because it's not dependent on your feelings. You don't have to feel ready to rest. You don't have to feel worthy of rest. The sun sets and you stop. The practice carries you until the feeling catches up. And that's a model that can be adapted even outside a religious framework. Make it non-negotiable. Not as a reward, but as a rhythm.
The rhythm part is key. All these traditions are rhythmic. Shabbat is every 7 days. The Catholic liturgical calendar has feasts and fasts in a cycle. Buddhist retreats are periodic. The rhythm itself is the teacher. You learn over time that the world doesn't collapse when you stop. The work is still there on Monday. The guilt is lying to you.
There's a psychological concept that maps onto this. The hedonic treadmill, we adapt to pleasure and then need more to get the same hit. Conditional happiness is the hedonic treadmill with a moral overlay. I'll be happy when I get the promotion. You get the promotion. You're happy for a week. Then it's, I'll be happy when I make partner. The goalposts move. The condition is never permanently satisfied because the mechanism is designed to keep you running.
The counter to that isn't to achieve more. It's to step off the treadmill entirely. To say, I'm going to eat this bowl of ice cream and enjoy it. Not because I earned it, but because ice cream is delicious and I'm alive, and that's enough.
I think this is where Heschel's palace and time metaphor is so powerful. If happiness is always in the future, you're never home. You're always traveling toward a destination that recedes. The palace is right now. The time you're in is already holy. Not because of what you accomplished in it, but because you're in it.
There's a phrase from the Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, that gets quoted a lot, but I think is often misunderstood. Who is rich? One who is happy with their portion. It's usually read as a call for gratitude, which it is, but it's also a direct attack on conditional happiness. The condition is always about a different portion, a bigger portion, a better portion. And the text says, no, richness is being satisfied with the portion you actually have right now.
That's from the same tradition that gave us Vital Torah, which is why I resist the idea that Judaism is simply a guilt factory. The tension is built in. The maximalist voice and the contentment voice are in the same canon, arguing with each other. The question is, which one you amplify?
I want to bring this back to something Daniel said at the very beginning. He talked about the micro level, the hard work mode, and then the relax mode, the feeling that watching a documentary requires having done the chore first. And I think that's where the rubber meets the road. It's not about grand philosophical commitments. It's about Tuesday evening, and whether you can sit on the couch without a mental ledger.
That's where the practice has to be concrete. One thing I've seen work, and this comes out of cognitive behavioral approaches, is to deliberately do the unearned thing and sit with the discomfort. Eat the ice cream first. Watch the documentary before the chore, not as a permanent lifestyle, but as an experiment in tolerating the guilt. The guilt is a feeling, not a fact, and feelings can be retrained.
Exposure therapy for the productivity obsessed. I like it. Sit in the discomfort of unearned joy until your nervous system learns that the sky isn't falling.
The research backs this up, actually. There's a whole literature on self-compassion. Kristen Neff is the big name here, showing that people who are kinder to themselves, who don't tie self-worth to achievement, are actually more resilient and more effective in the long run. It burns people out.
The Puritans were wrong about the psychology as well as the theology.
Weber saw the iron cage but didn't know how to get out of it. The counter-traditions had the exits marked the whole time.
I think there's one more thing worth saying before we wrap. The conditional happiness model has a hidden assumption, which is that happiness is a scarce resource that needs to be rationed. You get a little bit after you've paid for it. But happiness doesn't work like that. It's not zero sum. Giving yourself permission to be happy now doesn't deplete some future happiness reserve. If anything, it builds it.
There's a Hasidic teaching about this. The Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, taught that sadness is not a sin, but it's a barrier. Joy, on the other hand, opens doors. It's not a reward for spiritual achievement, it's the precondition for it. You serve God better from joy than from guilt, and that's a complete inversion of the Bitul Torah guilt model. Joy isn't what you get after you've learned enough Torah. Joy is what makes the learning possible in the first place.
The Baal Shem Tov, patron saint of eating the ice cream first.
I think he'd be okay with that characterization.
To pull this together for the prompt. First part, we trace the ideological roots through Calvinism, Bitul Torah maximalism, and Stoic self-discipline. Three streams that converge on the idea that time must be optimized and rest must be earned. Second part, we found counterpoints in the same traditions. Shabbat and Menuchat in Judaism, holy leisure in Catholicism, grace in Luther, non-attachment in Buddhism, just sitting in Zen, absurd happiness in Camus. The counter-traditions all say some version of the same thing. The present moment is not a down payment on a future joy. It's the thing itself.
The practical takeaway is that you can't think your way out of this. The guilt is trained in, and it has to be trained out. Rhythmic rest, deliberate practice, tolerating the discomfort of unearned joy. The goal isn't to eliminate the productive impulse. It's to put it in its place. Work is for 6 days. Rest is the seventh. Both are holy. Neither is contingent on the other.
The conditional happiness model says you get to rest when you deserve it. The counter-traditions say you deserve it because you're alive. That's the whole argument in one sentence.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 11th century, a Nepalese monastery recorded the excavation of a frozen yak carcass from permafrost at high altitude. The monks, believing they had discovered a creature from a prior age of the world, documented the event in a palm leaf manuscript that was rediscovered only in 2019, making it one of the earliest known written accounts of permafrost fossil exposure in the Himalayas.
Hey, frozen yak from a prior age! I have questions I know won't be answered.
I'm just impressed the monks took field notes.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps more people find the show.
We'll be back with a new prompt soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.